Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that is Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6 in B minor, Pathétique, which premiered on this day in 1893, just 9 days before Tchaikovsky died. This premiered in St. Petersburg during our day in history. And we are deeply honored here on the Mark Steiner Show and here at Morgan State University to have with us Gloria Rolando. She is one of the most renowned documentary and filmmakers in the world. She comes from Cuba. She's made more than 14 documentaries, incredible films. One I remember that really meant a lot of us was Ogun, An Internal Presence, which was just an amazing piece. My Footsteps in Baragua, Eyes of the Rainbow, about Assata Shakur. And this new work she's been doing around Grace de Mi Corazon, a new film that she did. All these other pieces she's done about the Independent Party, Colored Party of Cuba, that she uncovered. So she's in our studio now, and Gloria Rolando, welcome to the United States, welcome to Morgan State University, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show.
Bueno, thank you very much.
It's lovely to have
yes,
you here.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
So, where do we begin? I remember as a very young man, I went to Cuba in 1968.
A long time ago, but you're still young.
Yes,
sure.
And one of the things that struck me about Cuba when I was there in 1968, the first time I went, was Ikiak and the filmmakers in that world. And I'm curious, from your perspective, what is it about Cuban culture and society that has allowed this incredible world of film to kind of be created and erupt?
Sí, bueno, you know that I am part of the Institute of Cuban Film.
Yes.
In 1968, I was in the secondary school. I was around 15 or 16 years old. But I never thought at that time that I would be part of the Institute of Films. And I never thought that I would be a filmmaker. Because you know that something that is very interesting, the majority of the filmmakers, They never went to a film school. No, so the majority of them, I think that only three of them, they used to go to a film school. But the rest, they were, you know, people who start making movies and learning at the same time. So this is something possible because the amount of and the reach of Cuban culture is the music, is the painting, is the theater, is the ballet, is the dance. So there are many elements in the Cuban culture that were integrated. And the writers, the literature,
yes.
Carpentier, Nicolas Guillén, and many others, and the Cuban music that is so strong.
Right.
So I think that they get all this heritage and say, well, we have so many things to say about this culture. Let's do it. And also the revalorization of our history, the history of the independence, the history of the struggle of the people during the Republic, that created a lot of expectation, especially in the documentaries and in fiction film. For the first time, the people have voice in the Cuban film. For the first time, we could see the real rumba, how the black people dance, not the rumberas of the 40 and the 50 that is a stereotype of the rumba.
Right.
But they were part of the mythic of the Afro-Cuban culture, you know, in the 40s, in the 50s. So I think that they, all these elements fit the filmmakers and they became, you know, the voices. The voices of this revalorization of the Cuban culture, the real Cuban culture.
The real Cuban culture. That's one of the things that struck me, because I want to talk about your films and what you've discovered. But let me start this way. One of the other things that struck me in my trip to Cuba, but even my first one in 1968, was that Cuban culture was really defined by Africa.
Yes, and Spain also. Yeah.
But everybody I was in their home or in their car with them, they all had a Santeria piece in their car, you know, an Ogun of some kind, or an Orisha in their car. even the white looking Cubans.
Exacto,
right?
Exacto. Right?
So, but in some ways, the black culture of Cuba has only been allowed to begin to flourish in the last 40 years, finding the real truth and root, which is part of what you're doing.
Always exist. Remember that during the colonial period, during the Republic, never was tolerated as the official culture, because the blacks, when they arrived to Cuba, like in the rest of the America, they were not considered as a human being. So their culture, the spirituality that they have inside, of course, that it was part of the culture of resistance. So they preserve, but the dominant culture doesn't bother them very much. But they had to transform. They had to try to find ways to maintain it. And, of course, that they lose many things because they didn't arrive here and to Cuba, and they didn't have a place where they have their shrines. They can develop their worship. It's something that they do in the forest, hide in the plantation system, that they don't have a space to live as a real human beings. So that's what I admire of the culture of resistance, how they were able to preserve in the memory, because no possibility to write. So during the Republic, they continue keeping this, and we didn't have books. It's just, you know, mm-hmm. in the culture that people have in their memory, in the songs, in the way to dance, in the storytellers, you know. It's following the elders, and that's how they preserve. And my first documentary, the name is Ogun, An Eternal Present, because in spite of all this discrimination that suffered this culture in the past, especially during the slavery time, it's still alive. So the people, during many years, they found their own way for the preservation of the African heritage. That also is mixed with many elements of the new continent, because we cannot talk about African roots in Cuba pure, because nothing arrived pure to the Americas. Right. It was transformed. And the Santeria issues is something totally Cuba, with African roots in the Yoruba land roots.
I think that one of the things that you're saying and have said is the whole idea of purity is a myth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything is an amalgam, is a mix of all the things we are. But at the heart of it, especially in Cuba,
exactly.
Puerto Rico, Haiti, many other places I could name, is Africa.
Yes, the language of the drums,
right.
The rhythm. You cannot talk about Cuban music without considering the language of the drums. It's in everything. Even we play the jazz.
Right.
The jazz in Cuba, the part of the playing, the piano, is like, you know, it's like a drum. The richness of the rhythm, and it's a percussion, you know. You feel the drums through the piano.
That film you made... I really want to talk about this, what you've uncovered here, because I think it's so important. I'm not even sure what films you showed here. What did you show here at Morgan so far?
My Footsteps in Baragua and The Roots of My Heart.
The Roots of My Heart, the dramatic film.
Yes, yes, last night.
Lovely movie.
Yes, I like it.
And I think that the Roots of My Heart touched on so much. I mean, it did touch on some of the contradictions of race in Cuba,
mm-hmm.
between more Cubans who look more white and the Cubans who are black?
It's not exactly like that. It's a chapter of the Cuban history that even black people, they don't know very much. It's the history of the Independent Party of Color, the only black political party that exists in the Cuban history, that finished dramatically in 1912. So The Roots of My Heart talk about a woman in the present. Mercedes is the main character, a black historian, a black intellectual woman that have two children. And she wants to know the truth about the grand-grandfathers. It's a mystery. Nobody talk about this photo. And between a reality and a dream, doing some research, she discovered that the grand-grandfather didn't abandon the grand-grandmother, but he died. He disappeared. he disappeared during the massacre of 1912. And after then, the silence, because this is a chapter of the Cuban history. Every country have a chapter that they don't talk too much.
Right.
In the case of Cuba, 1912, the history of the Independent Party of Color is still painful. It's still painful because it's a massacre that happened around 10 years after the process of the independence. It was at the beginning of the Republic. It was the same people who were fighting for the independence from Spain. And the Republic arrived, and the black people were complained very much because they didn't see the expectation that they have, and they don't see, you know, much progress. And for that reason, they organized the Independent Party of Color. But they killed, at that time, the same people who were fighting for the independence of Cuba. So it was very painful.
And, you know, I before I ask very specific questions about that period and what happened with the Mambi fighters and the independence party that existed after, when in the film, you had the young woman kind of discovering all these newspaper clippings and finding this history. Is that how you did it? Is that what happened? How did you discover it?
Doing the same, right? I am very curious. And remember that I dedicate the film to Sara Gomez and her documentary, Chronicles of My Family.
Sara Gomez
was the first woman that made films in Cuba, inside the Institute of Cuban Film. And she has a documentary where she shoots herself talking to Madrina, one old members of her family. And she wants to know about the black society. She used in the film old photos of the family. She wants to know who were these people. How did they live after the slavery system? How did they grow the family? Who were the other people? Because normally we don't know very much about the past of our family. So that inspired me, you know, to take care this way to talk about the Independent Party of Color, not directly,
right,
sino through a family history, through something that can touch the heart of the people, and also to present how was destroyed the black family in that moment, because the disappearance of the Mercedes grandfather is a meaning that many others disappear just to be a black member or not of the Independent Party of Color. And after the silence.
Right. And so let's go back to that. I mean, the struggle for independence in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that, you know, because when we look at pictures, we don't see that. We don't see, and let's talk a bit about the Mambi fighters and who they were.
They were members of the Liberation Army. In the Liberation Army, there were...
This is the 1890s, the 1880s,
yes,
right?
80s, yes. We have two main periods of war, 1868 until 1878, and then again 1895 until 1898.
When independence happened.
Exacto. So... they were, the Liberation Army were integrated by a slave, ex-slave, free people, owners of plantation, even some Spaniards also, criollos, so those who were born in Cuba, but they won the independence. So it was, the composition was very, very interesting. And we have many important black generals.
This is
high level, like Antonio Maceo, Quintín Bandera, and many others that they were, you know, in the front line of the Liberation Army, and especially Antonio Maceo and all the members of his family.
So, since you said that, I have to ask this one question, because, you know, we remember, those of us who know Cuban history, even those who don't, remember names like José Martí.
Of course.
The great writer Guantanamera and other things he wrote. But we forget Antonio Maceo and he was like an, he was an equal. I mean, he was a member.
No,
of the
bueno,
revolution.
Maybe people they don't know very much, but in Cuba they it's do. Very important because if you visit Santiago, you see the huge statue that exists.
Oh no, yeah,
and there. Even yes. in the in yes. In Havana, they have a monument, and there are many schools and institutions that have Antonio Maceo's name. And Antonio Maceo's mother, Mariana Grajales, she's the mother of the homeland.
What does that mean, mother of the homeland?
Sí, es la madre de la patria.
Right.
Es la madre
de la patria.
De la patria, the mother of all the Cubans. Sí.
And why is she called that?
Because she, all the children that she had, not only Antonio Maceo, mm-hmm. all of them, she gave it to the process of the independence. And she was fighting her also in El Monte, in the forest, with the Liberation Army. She is a symbol of the women, of the Cuban women that that made possible the independence of the island.
One of the things that that part of the history that I know you talk about and that is missing a lot, at least in this country, in the United States, is that. Is the role that the United States played in the destruction of the Black Freedom Army and Black Freedom Fighters in Cuba because America was terrified of, from 1868 to 1900, of what Black Cubans were doing because of what it might mean for America, you know?
Well, you know that the first intervention was in 1898. And when they went to Cuba, they brought the Buffalo Soldiers. They went with separate regiments. And this is a chapter very interesting because the Buffalo Soldier arrived to Cuba to integrate the army against Spain. And here in the United States, you call this war American-Spanish War.
Right.
It's a mistake. It's Cuba la guerra hispano-cubana americana, because the Cubans were there fighting for 30 years and they continue and they were there until they get the independence. But I know that here you study como guerra hispano-americana, but in Cuba we study la guerra hispano-cubano americana. And at the end, bueno, Spain it was, ¿cómo se dice?
Defeated.
Yes.
Defeated.
And it was the end of the war, but also it was the beginning of the intervention of United States after the main explosion.
Of the ship, the main.
The ship main, yes.
And there's still theories about how that really happened.
See, see. So there are many issues, you know, related with the between the history of the two countries, and this is a chapter very interesting. Because, for example, when the Buffalo Soldier arrived to Cuba to mm-hmm. fight for the independence of Cuba, they realized that there were a lot of Black people in high position in the army with a lot of recognition. At that time, Antonio Maceo died, and José Martí also. Mm-hmm. But they hear, they listen the mythic about Maceo, because the men that used to fight with him were still alive. And they were proud to be part of the Liberation Army under the leadership of Antonio Maceo. And that's how some of them never returned to the United States.
Some of the Buffalo Soldiers.
Yes, they remain in Cuba. They remain in Cuba, some of them. They brought the banjo. Because they traveled with their music.
The Buffalo Soldiers brought the banjo to
the
Cuba.
Banjo to Cuba. And they start playing some the early song. And in Cuba, some Black people start the early jazz. Because so it was, you know, both things. They brought the banjo and they took the song and the guitar.
That's fascinating.
See. This is something that some musicians, musicologists, mm-hmm. they have been studying, the early influence. And this is a fascinating project, you know, to develop in the future.
If it is, mm-hmm. you got me interested.
But we were talking about the presence of
yes.
the United States in the early years of the Republic, because that also have an influence in relation with how they trade the black people. So Cuba arrived to the 20th century with the influence and the racism of 400 years of slavery, and also the presence of, you know, the segregation that established the Jim Crow and the rules related with black and white and in the Cuban society at the beginning of the Republic. For that reason, the people of the a group of black decided to organize the Independent Party of Color.
Let's talk about that for a few minutes, because at that particular period that you and others have really uncovered and reintroduced to the rest of Cuba and the world is really important. I mean, I read some of the pieces on your website, you know, just about how there were people arguing that the Cuban, the Independent Party of Colored People was not anti-white, that it was for justice and progressive
they
policies.
They have members of that were white. And if you check the program of the Independent Party of Color, they ask the education, free education for everybody, for all Cubans. That is something very important and the people, it's very difficult here to understand. I am black, but first of all, I am Cuban. Since the process of the independence, we say we don't want anything as black. We want everything as Cubans. So it's very, I know that it's very difficult to understand these kind of terms, but that's how our idiosyncrasy mm-hmm. arrived at the 20th century. All of us, we feel as a Cuban. And this is something that is very strong and exists until the present.
But what was it that led then to 12,000, whatever that number was, of members of the Colored Independent Party of Cuba to be murdered, to be assassinated, to be...
Because they didn't want that party.
Who did not want?
The government of José Miguel Gómez and the government at that time. Remember that Cuba was under the influence of the Haitian Revolution. The fear to black is something that was present in all the 19th century. And in the 20th century, they were so scared about the influence of the black republic that exists in Haiti that they don't want to create any kind of mythic around this. Of course, for them, it was easy to not to talk about the program of the Independent Party of Color, not to say the progress that they want to do for all the Cubans. It was much better to accuse them as a party that was racist. And never they made any kind of diffusion or expose the program that they have for all the Cubans. So sometimes they presented the two leaders, Evaristo Estenoz and Pedro Ibonet, as a Napoleon
complex. Yes.
That is the Toussaint Louverture, you know, they want to become in Cuba the emperador. So they have cartoons in the magazines of that period that try to present them and create a negative image. And they did, instead of the propaganda or the party or why those people want, you know, to regenerate the black people in Cuba. So they never talk about anything about positive. And I check a lot of the newspaper.
So what? But there was also a role, the United States played. I mean, there was a lot of fear in this country of that party and of black Cubans in the early part of the 20th
century. See, but especially when they see that the uprising will bother or put in danger the properties that they have. Because the party was founded during the second intervention of the United States. So it was the government of the United States who approved the existence of the Independent Party of Color. And it's very interesting. But at that moment, well, a black political party is the kind of separation that they have here. University parties, a hospital, maybe is cultural institution for black, for white, maybe it doesn't bother very much. But when the Independent Party of Color try to, you know, to create an obstacle for them, when was the end? No more.
Pardon me. Excuse me.
No problem.
So, I mean, so what? So this was lost to history for a long time.
It was there. Anything is lost.
It was always, but I mean, it was not.
And I know that there were many people that knew about this, historians, even black families, but it was not exposed, for example, to the education. I was in the primary school, secondary school, university. I never knew about this. And in the second chapter, I remember that I interviewed an old painter that he lived in Santiago de Cuba in the eastern part of the island. He said, I finished at the university. I never heard about this. And he's from Santiago de Cuba, where the majority of the event happened. So it's something that it was a complicity of el terror, people who were terrified, the shame also, because they couldn't get a victory in that moment. So maybe many people preferred not to talk about this, to say, my father was a Mambi, he belonged to the Liberation Army, but not so much about my father, my grandfather was a member of the Independent Party of Color. Or in the middle, in the silence of the family, you know, in the small nucleus of the family, but not spread with proud about this, because they were presented as a traitor of the nation. It was really, they tried that they repress the people, but also those who were alive, being member of the party or not, they tried to feel that it was a shame for the nation.
So we have to, I know you have a lecture to do in a few minutes, but so tell me very quickly, what films are you working on? What's the next project for Gloria Orlando?
Bueno, I just finished a new one related with the migration of people from Haiti.
Oh, I read
that
about
is a reembarque, reshipment. After the massacre, the sugar industry needs cheap labor force, especially in Cuba that's supposed to produce sugar. Remember that in 1914, it was the First World War, and the role of Cuba was to produce sugar, and they need cheap labor force. So they called people from all the Caribbean to arrive to Cuba and work as in the sugar industry. And that's the film that I am presenting now, the last one that I finished. And the new one is related, that is only in my mind yet. I am trying, you know, to get the funding and the logistic for this project that is related with my grandmother, the founders. It will be about my grandmother, but it's related with the founders of many of our family that with their hands, they helped to raise the family.
Well, Gloria Orlando, it's been an honor to have you in my studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
And thank you.
For being here at Morgan State University.
And thank you for the song.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here. And Gloria Orlando is giving a talk about telling the African diaspora history through film here in the Communication Center at Morgan State University from 11 to 1 p.m. right here where we're broadcasting, just downstairs. So if you're around, go hear her. We're going to go out with Que No Mar by Fernando Chaos. He was a Cape Verdean, one of the great Cape Verdean singers who died on this day in 2005. We'll be right back with sound bites and about the antibiotics that may be affecting your health in the food that you eat. Stay with us. We'll be right back. ¶¶